Lang Lang, Susan Bullock, Edward Gardner, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, works by Bartók, Wagner, and Richard Rodgers, and a second half filled with majesty, pomp, and circumstance. The Last Night of the Proms 2011, BBC Television and BBC Radio 3, this Saturday night from 7:30.
And before that, Susie Klein is indeed back at the Proms, as she just mentioned, to present tomorrow night's concert, the first of two, by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, with their music director Manfred Honeck. And Hélène Grimaud is the soloist in Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. It's also music by Braunfels and, after the interval, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. The Proms tomorrow night on Radio 3 at 7:30. The time now is just after 12 midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And this edition of the programme was first broadcast in April last year.
Edmund Duval is one of the world's leading ceramicists. He has porcelain in numerous museums, and he began life as a potter in Canterbury, studied in Japan, and then read English at Cambridge. I think you threw, as they say, your first pot at a very early age, Edmund.
Yes, I was five, and for no good reason, I decided that I wanted to go off and make a pot. And my father, bless him, took me to an evening class where I threw my first pot, which was very small, and very dumpy and white. I remember it being white.
Tell me a little bit about the distinction, because there will be people listening who won't know precisely the difference between earthenware, stoneware, porcelain, the things that you concentrate on.
Well, I make porcelain, which is basically the finest of all the clays. Clay comes in all kinds of conditions. It comes from the terracotta that you might find in the garden, or in a French country cooking pot you might find in your kitchen, to stoneware, which you might find from the mugs you've bought on holiday in Cornwall, to porcelain, which has this great tradition from the Far East and from Europe. And for me, porcelain is where it's at. Porcelain is the most exciting material because it's a strange in-between material between clay and glass.
And it has a wonderful sort of delicacy to it too.
It's got extraordinary delicacy. I mean, the pots that I make with porcelain, actually some of them are translucent, which even after 40 years of making things out of clay feels to me quite wrong, that you can make something where the light comes through.
If we go back to those early days when you were starting to get fascinated by throwing a pot here and there, was there music in your life at that time?
There was extraordinary amount of music, though neither of my parents are musicians. My father was a cleric and my mother's a theologian, and we grew up both at Lincoln, basically in Lincoln Cathedral, and then subsequently at Canterbury, where we lived just next to the cathedral, where my father was the dean. And so there was extraordinary amount of music. It's very difficult to describe this, but the music and the architecture were completely interlaced. I used to walk constantly through the cathedral, and apart from going to services there, the school was also there. And so my experience of music from really quite early on was about place and sound coming together. And so intense early memories of choral music.
And the first piece was presumably something you heard quite frequently.
Many, many times.
Yes. Orlando Gibbons.
Yes, it's a fantastic piece.
What is it about it, musically, do you think, that you really gotten on to?
Well, it's very difficult for me to actually answer that, because when I hear it,
it's so bound up.
It's so bound up with place. And there's something about the complete specificity of choral music in a place that I find very, very interesting. I found it interesting then, and I find it more and more interesting now, which is the fact that, you know, a sung piece of music in a particular building can seem so utterly other when it's sung somewhere else. When I hear this music, I'm in the choir at Canterbury Cathedral.
Thank you.
I was thinking, as we were listening to that, that there's something about the delicacy of line which must find its correlation, if you like, in what you do.
There's the delicacy of line, there's also the sort of unpicking of a theme and then the weaving it back together again. I mean, what I do is I don't make a single object and put a single thing out there. I make many objects and then bring them together. I make groups of porcelain, which I then bring into relationship with each other.
They're complete installations.
They're complete installations.
Yeah.
And in that way, you know, Gibbons is a very good example. Yeah. I mean, the music that I love and the music that I come back to and listen to and work to, there's lots of music I can't work to. We might get onto that later. But the music that I can work to often has that sense of something unfolding, of one thing being repeated and then come back to and return to and changed in the return.
Well, we heard the Magnificat from the second service of Orlando Gibbons with Canterbury Cathedral Choir, directed by David Flood, with Michael Harris playing the organ. If porcelain is the sort of material you choose to work with above all others, then I suppose Bach is the composer you probably would choose.
Yes, and I've been worrying away at this because I realised that I could so easily have given you a dozen. We could have sat and listened to Bach, and I wouldn't have had any problem just choosing one Bach piece after another, after another, after another. And I find it very hard to say why Bach is just so important to me.
This piece in particular, though, I would say possibly gives one a clue, because not only is it so aesthetically satisfying in terms of form, but it's very powerful emotionally too.
It's hugely powerful, and it's sort of uncompromising. I mean, it's a very, very extraordinary piece of music. It's beautifully sung, of course, here by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. I think we're using one of the early recordings that he did of this.
It's the opening of a cantata which bears this name that we hear straight away, isn't it?
Yes.
Karbegenuk, which basically means it is enough, Lord, really.
Yes.
Always, I've thought, a very profound and touching sentiment, because it suggests that the Christ figure is vulnerable and has frailty.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely about the incarnation, isn't it? This is the piece where actually there is no lower point that you can go. And there is always that feeling with Bach's religious music that he really has gone within, and that the sort of dramatising of the story is particularly personal dramatising of a story. It's not sort of off-the-shelf chorales or off-the-shelf emotion that he's jumping through a hoop for another bit of Sunday music, but this really is intensely personal.
Oh,
when you hear a performance like that, somehow, whether it's an early music specialist group or a more traditional form of hearing Bach from 30 or 40 years ago, seems totally irrelevant, doesn't it?
It's very odd. There are lots of bits of music which I listen to where I would choose one particular style. Mm-hmm. And with this, it seems to be an irreducible core to it, which survives.
Quite apart from the absolutely wonderful singing of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, the oboe playing of Manfred Clément is...
I know, and the conversation between the oboe and the voice there are... It's completely wonderful.
And rather like the opening of the St. Matthew Passion or the Barclay Minor Mass, there's that kind of inevitable unfolding to the line.
I know. What's so strange about it is that even though you've kind of heard it 50 times, 100 times, you're still utterly surprised by the conclusion, and you know how it's going to unfold, but there is a sense of inexorable, exactly, about it, which is extraordinarily satisfying.
That was the opening of Ich habe genug, the Bach cantata BWV 82. We heard Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, Manfred Clément, and the Münchner Bach Orchestra, directed by Karl Richter. Now, I'm very fascinated by something you said earlier, Edmund de Waal, and I want to apply it to these two pieces. Because, see, I can see that with something like that, there's an element of disturbance to the listeners. I would find it very hard to concentrate on anything else at all while listening to that. It would completely grip my attention. With the next music, and this is not a pejorative statement because it's extremely attractive and bubbling and lively, but with the next music by John Adams, I can see it more as because you were talking about repetition and patterns. Not that the Bach doesn't have repetition and patterns. So where do you fit into that?
There's lots of music I can't work to. It's too powerful. I'd start to make something and I would completely lose it all. I'd get up and pace around the studio and I wouldn't possibly be able to. I couldn't make Potts to one of the Passions. But I can't make Potts to an opera either, any opera. But there are kinds of music, loosely, you could describe them as minimalist music, which have a sort of slow unfolding, that sense of controlled improvisation, that return to themes again and again and again, which are extremely useful to work to. The thing is that when you're throwing on the wheel, there's a lot of time to think. Because I've been doing it for quite a while, my hands actually know what they're doing. My mind is all over the place. My mind comes and goes, trying to work out quite where I'm going to put these pots, how I'm going to work out the cadences of the pots that I'm making. And actually often listening to particular kinds of music helps me slow down, helps me pace myself better.
I was thinking in one, there's one set of pots, well, there's a lot of them actually, where you've got sometimes just one indentation, which is almost like the opening on an organ pipe, you know, where it speaks. Mm. And that'll be in a pattern, so that'll be repeated in form and in a slightly different way. So that is a bit like something like Adams, which we're going to hear next, where the harmony changes just fractionally.
Absolutely, and I mean, I've made installations, groups of work. Installation is such a horrible art world term, but large groups where that's completely happens. I mean, I made a wall, a porcelain wall of pots. It's 600 pots. And it's basically the same form. It's a very simple cylinder. It's basically the same glaze, a Celadon blue-green glaze. There's basically the same mark of my thumb and the heel of my hand and just a small mark, the mark that I put on every pot at the end of a wooden seal. And yet, putting them together and bringing them into rhythmical connection with each other does produce something which is much greater than the single object.
Thank you. Music from Shaker Loops by John Adams, the London Chamber Orchestra, directed by Christopher Warren Green. The last movement from it, a final shaking. That could almost be the equivalent of an exercise in glaze. I mean, that it's an exercise in texture.
Yes. I suppose I sort of believe in passionate minimalism, that, you know, minimalism doesn't have to be dull. It doesn't have to be purely a cerebral exercise in working out variations or a visual exercise in working out variations. It can be absolutely bodily immersion in working something out again and again and returning to something and making it happen. And it can be completely passionate, but there can be an intellectual structure there as well.
Curiously, the next piece is actually called Porcelain.
Yes. I mean, this is Moby. I have people who work with me in the studio, and so I've been introduced to quite a lot of music that I didn't actually know about. And Moby is one of the people who was brought into the studio who I hadn't actually known his music before. But again, this is music that is actually very easy to work to, and no bad thing either.
It just shows, really, that categories and sort of labels are really rather pointless. I mean, things are either good or the bad.
Yes. And, and there's always a need for some people to tidy things up into genres. Mm. You know, I always get very anxious when people are policing all those boundaries between genres and making sure that people don't transgress.
Porcelain by Moby. You have an exhibition on at the moment in London at the Alan Kristea Gallery with a Malevich title, I think.
Yes, it's called From Zero. Yes, it's a quotation from one of Malevich's great angry, polemical reorderings of the world, when he says that all art begins either from zero or in zero. It's a wonderful, dense text by him. And it's quite a big exhibition for me. What I've done is to make a series, which are in some ways a sort of homage to Malevich's famous black square and white square, his very reduced paintings that he did. I've made a series of boxes, lead-lined and plaster-lined boxes, in which there are very few vessels, porcelain vessels. So there's a series of plaster boxes with very pale vessels in them, and a series of lead-lined boxes which have darker and darker and darker vessels.
Sounds quite Rothko-like.
Well, that's also rather wonderful as a parallel. The idea behind them, and the feeling that I wanted to get, it was making a space where pots could be surrounded by shadows, basically could be in, have a sort of shadowy presence. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is just to make places where these pots can be seen and looked at carefully. But also it's a whole journey through shadows and a journey through colours and a journey through form.
Well, I thought it was a good moment to mention that because the next piece we're going to hear comes from one of the darkest composers, yes, I can think of.
Yes, it's the Tenebrae responses from Gesualdo. Darkest in all senses. Yes. He was a murderer, wasn't he? Amongst many other things.
But there's something also about the harmony, the chromaticism of the harmony, which takes it into a kind of dangerous world, doesn't it?
It does, and that's particularly appropriate because this is Tenebrae. This is the service that happens absolutely on the cusp of Easter. A great dramatic service where this is sung while all the candles in the church are blown out one by one, and so you start in light and you end in darkness. And this was a piece of music that means a huge amount to me. In fact, I made a group of pots called Tenebrae in response to this, which were a series of vessels, large vessels, each of which had a sort of different greys inside them. And we placed them on the floor of a chapel in Cambridge and sang this service over the porcelain.
Thank you.
Of course, we didn't hear a great deal of the harmony there because it was more the Gregorian chant. But it has an extraordinary quality which again takes one back to, as you were saying earlier, to architecture, doesn't it? Somehow you need to hear that music in a great cathedral or...
Yes, and you need, you need to hear the responses, you need to hear the echo. When you hear a voice in space, it changes the space it's in. The voice takes on the quality of the space. It's a conversation between the space and the voice. And it's taken me a long time to work this out in what I do, which is that you put something, you bring an object into a building, into a space, you put it on the floor, you put it high up, you put it on a windowsill, and it changes the dynamic of the space.
Alieni insurrexerunt from the Tenebrae Responses for Good Friday of Carlo Gesualdo. And we heard the Taverner Choir directed by Andrew Parrott. Well, Mozart is indeed next. We were speaking of him just now. And in fact, I think, again, it is that thing of tension and release that interests you here, Edmund de Waal.
Yes. I mean, there is a wonderful poem by Herrick where he talks about wild civility. And this is, for me, I mean, it's just a fantastic sonata, but this has that quality of great civility. I mean, it's a hugely civilized piece of music, and there's a sense of wildness in it. I mean, we're hearing the first movement. If we went on, we'd end up with the great Turkish march at the end of the piece, which, of course, is Mozart in Vienna responding to, I think, the Turkish marching regiment that went past his window in Vienna. I love Brendel playing this. You get the feeling that he has lived this bit of music very, very intensely.
Thank you.
always like listening to pianists of that calibre for the sheer beauty of the voicings of the different parts. Do you know what I mean? So you can, the way they're balanced, beyond anything I could probably ever dream of doing, however good I get at the piano.
Yes, and there's a sort of expansiveness there, where you feel that he actually is making it up, that he hasn't decided how to play this. He is discovering how to play it as you listen to it. I mean, that is fabulous.
Alfred Brendel playing part of the first movement from the sonata in A, Kirkel 331, by Mozart. Well, now back to music I imagine that you like to work to.
Well, it's by Brian Eno. Mm. And Eno is a great maverick artist, someone who has been a great pioneer of sampling and quotation and all kinds of layerings of different kinds of music.
And allowed other people to realise themselves.
Absolutely. Great producer of other people's and collaborator. And so I like him for what he does as much as for this particular bit of music.
This, from Another Day on Earth by Brian Eno, an extraordinarily curious and infectiously enthusiastic creative personality.
Yes, as I said, I mean, it's not just the music he produces, it's what he manages to do with other people, which is so interesting. And increasingly, I think that's the idea of collaborating across different art forms, which is what he does so successfully, is something that appeals to me enormously.
Well, finally, we're going to have Benjamin Britten. I was rather amused because when you were talking about the music you might have, you mentioned a sort of English domestic modernism. And I know exactly what you mean, in a way, because it's not really modern, in a way, and yet it has a kind of, from a sort of domestic modernism, makes it sound okay.
Well, there is that sort of softening of modernism that goes on. It's often that the view through a window, sort of a Ben Nicholson series of vessels on a windowsill or a Winifred Nicholson tree outside a window. And in fact, actually, I heard this for the first time actually in Kettle's Yard in Cambridge, the collection of Jim Ead, which is, of course, the perfect expression of that.
And do you know something really interesting? In the Red House at Aldborough, Britten's home, over the mantelpiece is one of the finest Henri Gaudier-Breschka portraits I've ever seen. And of course, Gaudier-Breschka was championed by Ead at Kettle's Yard.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what you have in Kettle's Yard, of course, is the layering of powerful Gaudier-Breschka bronzes next to driftwood with an Alfred Wallace seascape above it. So you've got this sort of sense of English modernism, of trying to accommodate complex modern ideas and idioms and somehow making them rather lovely in the process.
Poetry was important here too, and it is important to you.
Hugely important. I mean, I always thought I was going to be a poet. But now, I read poetry a lot, and a lot of my work comes out of reading particular poems or thinking about particular poems. And of course, I realised when I was making my list of music that almost all the music that we've listened to, of course, has the voice in it, and that I do love listening to music which is based on poetry. And this is very, very important.
very charming the way those sort of lullabying strings come in after the solo horn.
I know. But the horn is just extraordinary. Two of my children, my wife, play the horn, and so my house is full of the sound of the horn. But Peter Pears and Barry Tuckwell together, it is one of the most wonderful bits of music of that period.
The prologue and pastoral from The Serenade for Tenor, Horn and Strings by Benjamin Britten, Peter Pears the tenor, Barry Tuckwell the horn player, with the strings of the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten. Well, thank you very much for introducing us to your work and the music that often accompanies it and sometimes doesn't.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a huge pleasure and privilege.
Private Passions, introduced by Michael Barclay, is a Classic Arts production for Radio 3. Today's edition was first broadcast in April last year, and the producer was Sarah Cropper. Next week, Michael's guest is the historian Sarah Tillyard. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. The time is 1 o'clock, time for the news with John Shea.
A suggestion by a front-runner for the leadership of the Scottish Conservatives, Murdo Fraser, that they should break away from their colleagues at Westminster has provoked a mixed reaction within the party. Mr Fraser, who is a member of the Holyrood Parliament, said the Conservatives had been in continual decline in Scotland since the 1960s and that a new centre-right party would attract more voters. The former Conservative Scottish Secretary, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, welcomed the idea as refreshing. But the sole Tory MP in Scotland, David Mundell, said he would need a lot of convincing that it would help the party. Forces opposed to Colonel Gaddafi are reported to be moving towards the Libyan desert town of Bani Walid, where it's thought members of the former dictator's family could have taken refuge. Negotiations for the town's surrender have been taking place for days, but it's thought the opposition may try to take it by force. Iran has announced that its first nuclear power station has begun producing electricity. Work on the Russian-built plant began more than 30 years ago. Iran has insisted its nuclear programme is entirely peaceful. The former Labour Chancellor, Alistair Darling, has spoken of a fraught working relationship with Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister. Mr Darling was giving his first broadcast interview since extracts from his memoirs started being serialised in the Sunday Times. Mr Darling told the BBC's Andrew Marr show that the situation became more heated after he publicly said in 2008 that Britain was facing arguably the worst economic downturn in 60 years. The former head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, is back in France for the first time since prosecutors in New York dropped the charges of sexual assault, which cost him his job. Mr Strauss-Kahn, who was accompanied on the flight from New York by his wife, made no comment to crowds of reporters awaiting him in Paris. And the weather. Outbreaks of rain will spread across eastern areas of England, as well as parts of Wales and southwest England later. Scotland will have scattered showers. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
Read by John Shea. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. In an hour's time at 2 o'clock, there's another chance to hear last Friday's prom. Prom given by the Budapest Festival Orchestra, conducted by Ivan Fischer. There are two pieces by Liszt and two by Mahler. We'll hear the pianist Dejan Lazic as the soloist in Liszt's Totentanz. And we'll hear Mahler's Blumine, which was originally intended to be part of his First Symphony, and we'll also hear a performance of the First Symphony. That's our Sunday concert, which starts at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. But right now, it's time for the Early Music Show with Catherine Bott.
Hello. In today's programme, a conversation with one of the true legends of historically informed performance, a virtuoso of the harpsichord and organ, a conductor, musicologist, teacher and editor, Gustav Leonhardt. He holds a unique place in the revival of the harpsichord. So let's begin with the sound of him playing one, in music by the composer with whom he's so closely identified, Johann Sebastian Bach. Thank you. The third and final movement from Bach's Harpsichord Concerto in D Major, BWV 1054, played by Gustav Leonhardt and the Leonhardt Consort. On a sunny May morning in a London hotel, Gustav Leonhardt, with his 83rd birthday just a fortnight away, was dressed for much colder weather. His slender build and aquiline handsomeness are, at first sight, quite austere. But he greeted me with grave courtesy, and although I suspect that there wasn't a question I could conjure up that he hadn't heard before at some time during the last 60 years, the twinkle in his eye and his wry smile proved, I hope, that he quite enjoyed thinking up new ways to answer every one. It's a fairly standard beginning to an early music show interview, but with someone like Leonhardt, who's been playing the repertoire for so many years, the question of when and how he'd first discovered the music that has dominated his life was bound to produce a compelling answer.
My parents were extremely musical, no musicians. Before the war, you could put on a record, but we didn't do that actually hardly, and so there was music at home. My father flute, my mother violin, and I was put on the piano. But strangely enough, my parents, being amateurs, thought when we play a Telemann or a Bach, we need a harpsichord. They had read about it, so they ordered one. And there it came, and I was put on it and played my written-out continuo part. I can't remember much of that. So a lot of music I heard, and even some early music, although also with Schumann and Brahms, everything went on. And then during the last year of the war, when everything stopped, and I had even to hide for the Germans, because I had really officially to work in Germany, because I was just 16, I think. We lived in the country, so the worst of famine we didn't feel so much, luckily. But the greatest pleasure then was that there was no school. You couldn't go out. So a whole year without school, that was a marvelous thing. So that harpsichord standing there took me completely. And I repaired it and I tuned it all day long and played a little also. And then innocent age, I thought, I want to be a musician for Bach. My father was on the board of the Dutch Bach Society, which still is there and flourishing. So it's Matthew Passion in the B minor Mass in the early years of the war still, and before and after. My father took me there and even to rehearsals. So I really was soaked in Bach, and really that did it, yeah. I think I wanted to become a musician because of Bach only.